Rihanna, continue, please.
So agenda paper 5.6A is the first paper in the series on the business model assessment in IFRS 9 and the FASB accounting standards update. And this paper focuses on the business model assessment in general. So the topics in this paper are relevant to all the measurement categories that we are discussing today. From a staff perspective, we just want to emphasize again that the recommendations we are making are only clarifications to the existing guidance in IFRS 9 and that proposed in limited amendment to ED and the FASB's proposed ASU. And we are not recommending making any fundamental changes to what we have. Now, this agenda paper is similar to agenda paper 6A that we discussed at the October joint education session. But we revised the paper to take account of the questions that the board members have raised and the observations made at that meeting. And the three main clarifications or revisions we've made to this paper is to make it clear that the business model assessment should consider how activities and risks are managed, rather than just which activities and risks are managed. That sales do not drive the business model assessment, but that information about past sales and expectations about the future provides evidence of the entity's objective for managing financial assets. And lastly, with regards to reclassification, that there's an intentionally high threshold put on reclassification, and that was to address the concerns raised by users of financial statements that a lower threshold would result in less rigor and consistency with reclassifications, and that entities could then opportunistically manage or decide when to recognize profits and losses arising from reclassification. So the staff recommendations on the meaning of the term business model and the level at which the business model should be assessed are summarized in paragraphs 72 and 74 of the paper. And in broad terms, these are to clarify that the business model refers to the actual management of financial assets, generate cash flows, and to create value for the entity, and that it provides information about how activities and risks are managed, and that the application guidance be clarified to make it clear that the level at which the business model should be assessed should be at a level that reflects how financial assets are managed together to achieve a particular common objective. With that, I will hand over to the board for discussion on these recommendations and to ask whether you agree with the staff recommendations on this.
Okay. Yeah, I have a question on CAF 60, which we recommend the phase of reclassification. Would only be possible then if it's significant to the operation, and that generally would be the case only when the entity has acquired or disposed of a business line. And I ask the question because all the discussions we had earlier in this paper saying, okay, if we have in the past seen, okay, there was, let's assume we are in amortized cost business model and have seen some sales which are not in line with that, and also we have the expectation that we will continue to have the more significant number of sales. And what an entity should do, because my reclassification is so strict that the guidance which we're giving them to the entity is, and it should continue to have that on amortized costs and not changing it to fair value ODI or collect and sell business model. So I really see that the restriction which we have here is too really restrict, because there can be situations where kind of policy change or intention is changed and not related to a disposition or acquisition of a new business. And my question is then, okay, what an entity should do? Because if he makes this so strict, really I think before this companies then, even if they have been many sales and will continue to expect sales, to stay in amortized cost business model and not reclassify into another one. And especially, I think, from the amortized cost to the fair value of the OCI, I think we should not make it so strict, because I personally don't see such a big difference, because you have the same P&L, and what you do in addition is you have then on the balance sheet, you have then the fair value information. So I would maybe make it more strict if you have to go from amortized cost maybe to fair value P&L, but I personally don't see it. And also, I don't know if you have asked users if that is such a problem, if an entity moves from amortized cost to fair value OCI.
It can make a big impact on your capital requirements.
That's right.
I don't think it's a small bit.
It's not, but it's not really a track of earnings management. You cannot influence your P&L. But as I said, my main point is, because I think we can have situations which is not generally then okay in disposition or an acquisition, where the management really changes kind of intent and will add in the past more sales and will also expect in the future. And then the question which I have, what should an entity do? Because reclassification is too strict, so they cannot do, they have to stay in amortized cost.
Just to be clear.
And I think that is also not adequate.
But just to be clear, it doesn't prevent you, or in fact, on an ongoing basis, things that you are newly recognising, you should be based on your current assessment of the business model. So we're just talking about sort of wholesale change in terms of stuff that's already on your balance sheet changing the way that it's been measured.
Yeah, for new stuff, but okay, you have your existing portfolio, you cannot reclassify. And that is my problem. I don't know what an entity should do in this kind of situation, because we're saying in the previous pages, we say, okay, they should look what they have done in the history, they should look what their expectation is in the future, and if they conclude, okay, I have more than insignificant sales, maybe I have to go more into the fair value of the I category, but based on this guidance on reclassification, which is too strict, so what should entity do? That is the question which I have, and therefore I think maybe we should make it a little bit more possible to change, and especially I think if we talking from amortized cost to fair value OCI, because that is what my reason, because I really don't think there is P&L, there is not such an impact. It gives an additional more information, because you have then the fair value information on the balance sheet, that is the impact. I agree with Hans, here you have an impact in OCI. That's it.
Also, I think, be quite a big change to IFRS 9, and it was a pretty significant decision for the board originally, and I know we can change our views, but just to point that out, and,
right,
and it was in response to very severe criticism the board got on the reclassification amendments we made.
Yeah, but at that point in time, when the board discussed, I think, IFRS 9, there was only two categories. There was amortized cost and fair value P&L. And we didn't have fair value OCI at
that point. But it was in reaction to the criticism we got, which included for things being moved from AFS to amortized cost in 39.
I just also just want to clarify that we are not saying you can only have a reclassification of existing assets on your balance sheet when you have an acquisition or a disposal. What we are saying is that you have a change in the business model when you either stop doing something you have been doing in the past, or you start doing something you haven't done in the past. And we're just saying that generally that is when you have an acquisition or a disposal, but we're not saying it's just on an acquisition or disposal of a business group or a business unit. It's just, I think we've just used that to demonstrate how big that change needs to be for you to be able to change the classification of something on the balance sheet that you have currently.
Yeah, but Brianna, we have said, when we had a discussion with, okay, if companies have a kind of credit concentration limit, and based on that we have many sales, and we think that is not in line with amortized cost, but that all can happen. And if we have this kind of wording, only when an entity has either stopped or started doing something on a level that is significant to its operation, and then saying, generally, that would be only the case when an entity has acquired or disposed of a business line. And I think there can be other situations where, okay, we will see more sales, and then the question is what an entity should do. Based on that guidance, I would conclude, okay, they should not reclassify. And that will result in a situation where you have significant number of sales and will continue to have significant number and have amortized cost, because there is no other solution to this. And that is what I think is an issue And maybe the solution for this issue to make it a little bit more, not so complicated, to reclassify if it is from amortized cost to fair value of the eye. Because I think, as I said, it is not a big deal.
I like the overall conclusions that staff are reaching in the paper, so support the general direction. I want to focus on one issue, though, that I think puts a fairly large responsibility on the reporting entity to document the level of aggregation in which they're designating a business model. And essentially, in paragraph 43 and then in your summary in paragraph 74, you say that the application guidance should be improved to clarify that the business model should be assessed at a level that reflects groups of financial assets managed together to achieve a common objective, and that makes eminent sense to me. However, I think in order to make that faithfully representative of what is happening from period to period, that's going to have to be well documented. And to Martin's point, if the business model isn't well documented, then the potential for reclassification, frankly, rises, I think. And you don't have a faithful representation from period to period. So the overall objective has to be articulated correctly. That's what I said last month. I think we need to have a very clear, crisp definition of business model for fair value OCI, for example. But in terms of how you're aggregating, I think it really is very important to have documentation here, and that should be part of the application guidance to ensure, just like a risk management system of any kind, the entity knows essentially what is in and what is out of that business model in order then to be able to make a bona fide judgment as to what is a reclass and what isn't a reclass. That was the thing that, and what really struck me were the words in paragraph 76C. You say, if cash flows are realized in a way that is different from the entity's expectations at the date of the business model, we talk about the consequences or lack thereof, but then we say, it doesn't result in a restatement, it doesn't change the classification as long as the entity considered all relevant and objective information. Well, the only way you're going to be able to come to that conclusion is to have good documentation. So that's, I think,
the
key point that
needs to come. And the key thing is being able to point to the evidence that you've used to make your point.
Exactly.
Doc? Yes, similar point. Let me put it differently. I'm still struggling whether we still have any room or not. The reason why I'm struggling is interaction between paragraph 76C2, which I have mentioned, and the interaction to the paragraph 60. Paragraph 76 says you don't have to change the remaining assets. However, paragraph 60 says you have to take into consideration for the future classification. So then it may end up you're not going to change remaining, but change the future, new one. So it ends up having the two business model for the similar assets.
So it seems like a skewed model. So the argument is similar to sunk cost.
Does the what happened in the past restrict the future behavior?
I think what happened in the past has nothing to do with the future classification. So if you have an intention to eliminate tainting rule completely, then to state that you have to take into consideration the past behavior for the future classification makes things complicated. So if you have an intention to remove the tainting rule completely, I don't think we should have this kind of wording.
Just to come back on this point that you raised, that you can have similar assets then in two different business models and measured differently. That can happen in any case under the business model assessment, because you can have bonds, you know, which you are holding to collect, and you can have similar bonds which you classify as fair value P&L. So you know, you can have similar assets being measured differently if they are being managed in a different way for a different objective.
But that is exactly the point Martin raised. So if you have a lot of inventory of debt securities, which may have a high interest rate, and then if you see the sharp interest decline, then you happen to sell some of the inventory of debt securities. And then, because of that, for the future purchase of similar debt securities, you would apply F3OCI. Then you have a fair value all to collect huge inventory and the fair value OCI for the future assets. But for the future assets, interest rate had already went down. Then it do not have a lot of unrealized gain, whereas the inventory you have, which has a high interest rate, may have lots of unrealized gain. Then when it comes to sell it again, I don't know what the opportunity is, regulatory reason, whatever, then probably that entity would sell from hold to collect category because it has a lot of unrealized gain. Nobody can stop it. So substantially, they have one business model. However, for the accounting purposes, it was divided into two business models. That's the accounting business model. So that is my observation.
But the business model assessment, or the business model, concept of the business model, if you tell me how the assets are managed, it's not just an accounting construct. It's not for accounting purposes that we have this. I mean, the business model tells you the story about how an entity manages assets, how it manages the risks and the activities related to those assets. And if it's different, then I think you need to account for it differently. But if it is the same, then I think they need to be accounted for in the same way. So I don't really...
Yeah, I do understand. I take all of your points. So that is what the business model is. But because we are saying that you don't have to change the past remaining assets, whereas you may have to change the future assets. So that would segregate the standard, assessment standard, the different assessment standard to the same assets. I don't know whether that is your intention or not, but reading through your paper, it seems like for the remaining, you don't have to change, or it's difficult to change. But for the future, taking into the past event consideration, and you have to take different classification. Eventually, it may end up having two different accounting business models.
And I think that's true, Jack. I guess the only observation I'd make would be that we don't want, and we try, I think, in the other papers, to try and de-emphasize selling, because we're getting into this habit, I think, of thinking that selling is driving the whole business model determination, and that's what we were trying to do. We might not have worded it in the best way, but that wasn't the intention. What we want you to do is look at things like business plans, how you compensate people, how you report to management, how do you assess performance, and then as a check, look at how much selling is going on. So first of all, I don't think that just because your level of selling changes, you should be saying, okay, now my business model's changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, Liz is whispering at me, and I would agree with her, but today, if you have lots of selling, that in itself can cause tainting and cause you to change classification, whereas I think in the new model, our idea is that if you've got changes in the level of selling, stop and think about whether that means that there has been a change in business model, but it's not determinative in itself. But to your general point about the fact, can I end up with the same assets being measured in different ways? The answer is yes, you can, even in the same business, putting aside business model, because as Martin rightly points out, we have quite a high hurdle for a reclassification of things that we've already booked. But that was a very conscious decision of the board to try and balance the usefulness of the information by having it relevant to the current way the business is being managed, but not having too much flip-flopping going on, which makes the accounting complicated and makes it really hard for users to, you know, do their trend analysis and understand what's going on. And we're trying to balance those two things.
Yes.
understand the issue. I think it's a difficult sense to make, but I think that the level of sales could be an indicator of a change in business model, and I think I would like to see that in this discussion in paragraph 61C, like tax rate. Otherwise, it is prone to abuse. People can just ignore the level of sales and continue to classify the whole portfolio as if nothing had happened, while at the same time beginning to create a new portfolio for the future, and ignore that the current portfolio is continuing to have a lot of sales. It seems to be inconsistent with the world model. So I think a level of sales could be an indicator of a change in the business model, and at least would trigger a reassessment and confirmation of whether the business model is unchanged or has really changed, and maybe no one noticed that.
How do you explain that sort of approach? Amaro.
I just would like to clarify, because what I heard from Tata and what I heard from Philippe is exactly, in my view, what the staff is proposing and what is written on paragraph 76, A, B, and C. So this is my understanding of the English wording here. So I'm really happy with this. And I'm not saying seeing sales as a trigger for immediate trigger to business model. And the paper brings lots of clarification and mentioned that we should not expect business models to change frequently. And this was not the expectation of users. And they have stressed that the flipping of categories between the three categories that we had in the past was very difficult for them. So I'm happy with this. If this is only the English wording to fine-tune this, that's okay. But I think this is the staff intention in here.
Yes.
There you go.
I agree with that proposal. I have two questions to ask you to clarify. One is on paragraph 38. You have two paragraphs, A and B, and we use two different kinds of objectives. One is in order to generate cash flow and create value for the entity. And the second paragraph is to create value. And my feeling is they should be the same, but here they are different. I'm not sure whether you intentionally make it a difference. And secondly, you know, I just compare our recent standards on reporting entity and about, you know, your assets. In that one, we not use the notion create value. You know, we use appreciation and other. I'm not sure whether we should be relatively consistent, not use different words in different occasions, you know, to make assessments related to, you know, fair value or not. Now, this is my first question, a clarification from you. Actually, there's two parts. One is why you use two different kind of objectives. One is create cash flow and generate cash flow and create value for the entity. Another one is to create value. And is there any intention for you to make a difference? And second one is, you know, whether we can use similar or words for assessment among different standards.
I don't think there's really an intention to create any changes or differences. So I think that generating cash flows and creating value is, it's not necessarily something, two different things.
So, no, I don't think there was any magic difference in A and B, probably just inconsistent words.
I think we should have probably put, in order to generate cash flows, down in B, how we should have just reproduced it in A and B. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And then how about the relationship between other standards? Here you create value, and in other standards we use such appreciation and other.
Young?
Sorry. I don't answer that.
I don't have a ready answer, so if you do, please.
I think we'll just look at. Yeah. We will look at To what extent
we can allow the question relates to the whether assessed based on instrument and instrument basis. At the beginning, you mentioned, you know, we clearly say that in our standards it is not. And FSB's proposal is not clear. And I noticed in paragraph 43, and I'm not sure whether staff this consensus among yourself between our staff and FSB staff, you know, in the middle, 43, you know, should be assessed at a level that reflects group of financial assets. And my question to you is whether we reach consensus already, and not instrument by instrument basis.
Yes, I think we are fully aligned, and we all agree. So there's no false difference. We all agree it's not an instrument by instrument assessment.
Thank you.
Jan?
Well, I already expressed that I'm not very happy with the direction we're going, but I have to live with it. So then I have to contribute in some way. And I think part of the comments given here explains very, very clearly that we are adding back complexity. The way I'm reading this is that we are more or less coming back to where we started. Today, I imagine very few companies are using IFRS 9. And therefore, I think it's a valid question to say, is it an alternative for us to go back to classification measurement as we have it in 39?
39?
Yes.
Not just current IFRS 9.
Most people use 39 today. We are more or less giving them the same outcome with this.
Everyone knows how to take it. I know how to classify. All routines are in place.
Slightly different outcomes, perhaps, but
that is not really true. For the incoming country, they have stopped using IFRS rather than going to IS-39.
Sure.
So for them, if we go back to IS-39, then they have to change twice. So the IS-39 is also new.
That's not the point. How many
are using 9 and how many are using 39 today? And if you take that sample and compare them with these two samples, you find a lot of people are using 39 and very few are using 9. 9 was to simplify, take out the complexity.
Well, I think that obviously I might have a bias, but in my view, it's still an improvement even if we have three categories, because one of the criticisms we hear about IS-39 today is that people don't understand why the same instruments are in different categories and they get different impairments as well. We can deal with that separately. But I think that the benefit that we've heard about, that people like about IFRS 9, and I think it's still true of IFRS 9 even if we were to add an additional category, is that there is a logic to why different instruments are in different categories. And I think that helps with understandability of the financial statements. Having said that, obviously, by having an extra business model, it's more difficult to delineate between three business models than with two. So that is harder. But I still think overall the improved logic in the way that things are classified is still an improvement relative to 39 today.
Just on the point of IFRS 9, as much as I don't like the third category, I do think there's an improvement in what we're doing. So I'd be supportive of carrying on. But I had a question about business model. And in paragraph 8, you list the three of possibly many factors that you might take into account. And it includes this, how do you report to management and how do you compensate management, which Sue mentioned. So my question is, I've always been confused about how important that is. So could you have no change in the business activity but a change in how you report to management and compensate management, and does that change the business model? And the example I'm thinking of is, let's suppose somebody adopts IFRS 9 prior to the insurance standards. So they go through a process of reclassification when they adopt IFRS 9. Insurance standard comes in, no change in how the business is managed. Same before and after, but as a result of the changed accounting for insurance contract liabilities, the way in which you would want to report to management the combination of the assets and liabilities, that itself changes. So there's a change in how you report to management on the asset side, but no change in the way you're actually managing the business. Is that a change in business model? Do you then reclassify one way or the other at that time?
No, I think the underlying principle of the business model assessment is still how you manage the assets and how you realize the cash flows and create the value. So it is still, if you're just reporting differently, but you're still managing the assets in the same way, I don't see that that is a change in the business model. But where this did come up as where it could have an influence the way you are reporting to management and the investors is for investment entities, for example, or the funds where they've got, they're not necessarily selling quite regularly the investments they have, but they manage those investments in a way that they report fair value information to management, they report it to the investors, they management is remunerated on the fair value, so they're actually managing the assets on a fair value basis, although they may have very little sales or trading of those investments, change in the investments. So I think those are, you know, it contributes to your assessment, but the underlying foundation should still be how you manage the assets.
So in paragraph 8, the key factor is the frequency of sales.
No, it's not the frequency.
It is above it. It is, but it's not limited. A, B, and C.
I think cash realisation is important, and we do emphasise that. I think that the challenge is making sure that it's not sort of period by period changes that's driving everything, and we're trying to balance between.
Okay. Over to you, Russ.
Okay. Anybody want to start? Any questions? Mark?
Sure, I've got a few points. On the level at which the business model is assessed, I don't disagree with anything you wrote. I just want to see if we could try to make it clear that the classification and measurement decision is an instrument by instrument decision. You're taking an instrument and trying to decide instrument by instrument which business model you're in. So that's an instrument by instrument decision. The business model assessment is not instrument by instrument. It's at the level at which you described it, at a higher level. But that's always been the confusing part, at least to me, as interpreting the document, is which part are we talking about, the classification measurement decision, which is instrument by instrument, or the business model assessment, which is the way you described it at a higher level. So just, you know, I'm hoping that we can make that clear in the document. Somewhere. It doesn't have to be necessarily in the standard. On the role of sales, there's a lot of discussion in London about paragraph 76C, which is the, you know, I worry about paragraph 76C. I understand why we thought it might be important to put it in there, but I've got a couple of concerns with it. First, I'm not sure it's all that helpful to begin with to say that, you know, after the fact, in hindsight, it's okay if you got it wrong, as long as you looked at all the relevant information and objective information at the time that you made the assessment. I'm not sure that's going to really help anybody. Pat Finnegan talked about all the documentation you might need to try to prove that, and so I'm not sure it's going to help out to begin with. And secondly, even if it did help out, I'm not sure I agree with the idea that well, I know it wasn't the idea, but I'm worried that we might be trying to give a free pass to people on correction of an error. If there was an error and somebody actually did have an error in making their classification decision, I don't think we can or should be saying, you know, you get a free pass and don't worry about it as long as you jump through all these hoops. I think if there's an error, there's an error. So I've got a couple of concerns with 76C, and I'd prefer it not being in there. And lastly, on the reclass date, the way I think about this issue and all issues like it, this to me is a secondary or even tertiary issue, and so I wouldn't want to have a difference in a secondary or a tertiary issue with the IASB. So if it makes a difference, you know, my vote would be to converge on this one. Even though I understand why we picked the date that we picked.
Larry? So I have some comments and concerns without any proposed solutions. Because on the one hand, I agree with what Sue Lloyd said before, that I think there's an improvement when you portray your assets in a fashion that's consistent with the business model that you're using. On the other hand, I feel that a lot of what has been put in this paper is such that it would allow people to do quite a few different things depending upon how they document it or what have you. I have significant concerns, and this might be a U.S.-centric type of an comment, but I have significant concerns given the audit and the regulatory environment that exists in the U.S. that about the operationality of the business model, particularly when you consider the high hurdle for reclassifications that Martin expressed concern about. I think that there it just appears to me as if we're opening ourselves up to some significant potential for second guessing, such that even though we like to say we don't have a tainting notion in the document, I think the ultimate tainting notion might prevail, and that is restatement. So, and like I said, I like portraying your assets or displaying your assets consistent with the business model, but you know, a lot of the language that we have about looking at sales and explaining your sales or what have you, such that I just have some concern.
So in essence, what you're saying is you agree with the objective of what we're trying to accomplish. You're just concerned about perhaps some of the lack of that maybe you need more clarity about how to judge the business model and changes in facts and circumstances related to the business model.
Yeah, and perhaps our assessment of reclassifications. And while I acknowledge that users have told us that they don't like reclassifications, but perhaps we're being, as Martin indicated, a little bit too strict. Okay.
Tom, then Hal, then Jim.
First of all, I think the staff has made some significant improvement in trying to help us think about issues here. The current model that we look at focuses too much on the frequency of sales to decide in hindsight whether or not classification was correct. I think we've all decided that in any one of these three categories, sales are appropriate at times. And so we end up with a model that in hindsight second guesses whenever there's sales out of the amortized cost category that leads to difficulty in application, a lot of second guessing, tainting, and other sorts of problems in the application of the model. And so what I think the staff's doing here is providing us with an opportunity, instead of focusing just on whether we cash, collect, or sell, what causes or motivates the degree or the amount of times that we cash, collect, or sell, so that when we end up making an evaluation as to whether sales occur, whether that's appropriate with the business model or not. And I think that's a huge opportunity to improve the current literature. While that being said, I still think that there are degrees of concepts that the staff have put together that there are too many of them, and it's hard to follow. So in this guidance, there are words like objective that you have to consider, activities, management performance, measurement and reporting, value creation, risks being managed, value realization, and outcome are all concepts that are embedded in this discussion, and I get lost with all those sort of concepts. And I think it can be simplified to create an understanding of what the methods of value realization are for specific business activities. So I like the direction a lot, but I would simplify it to three things. Start with a business activity that leads to how the assets are managed, or more specifically, what risks are being managed, that lead to an understanding about the value realization methods that are consistent with that value creation, noting that there might be primary methods for value realizing, and then there may be secondary things that happen, the degree of collection or sale, and that should naturally fall out. And if we did that consistently, you'd know when a business model changed, because it would be activities, risks, and degrees of value realization that would naturally change as you go forward. So, and I think as we go forward applying this, that you will see that when we go to the amortized cost paper, the next one, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The objective is that cash collection, and the outcome is cash collection. That doesn't leave much thought process for the frequency and the magnitude of sales. But if you were to turn around and say, at least in the paper that you're looking at, that you may have financing the activity or even an investing activity at amortized cost, that's your sales-driven, regulator-driven sales situation, that you are either financing and or investing to end up collecting cash flows, that is to collect principal and interest through time, that causes you to have to manage credit risk to maximize those cash flow collections, you would expect the value realization would be mostly cash flow collection, with the sales either coming about because of credit deterioration or regulatory-driven sales for those circumstances, or even if you maximize the cash flows that you're collecting, you could sell at the end because there's not hardly any cash flows left to collect. All three of those things. You can do that, and you did it far better in the fair value OCI area. But if we talked about those three things consistently, starting with the business activity and running all the way through, I think you'd change the conversation greatly, link it all together, and stop the silly focus on looking at any sale being a problem in certain circumstances.
Can I just clarify? All right. Is what you're saying is when you look out at all three business models, what you're ultimately saying is you're trying to judge value realization, and the activities, the management reporting, the risks are different. So in value realization, in other words, in amortized cost, you're looking forward to value realization is collecting the cash flows, collecting the principal and interest. That's the predominant activity you're doing and how you're going to realize. In OCI, it's more investing, and in net income, it's more trading. Is that ultimately
Yes, in a way, but you're still focusing on the judgment of value realization mostly. But yeah, I think if we start with the activities first, how much you collect and stuff.
My question is, are you using the activities and the risk and the management reporting to judge the value? What I heard you saying is that one of your concerns is there seems to be five or six different things that are all equal. And it seems like you're saying the ultimate objective should be how you are realizing the value. And these are the things you look at to judge how you think you're realizing the value. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying the outcome or consequence of certain business activities will result in certain amounts of value realization. And once we know what that is, we'll know how to classify it. But on day one, when I invest in that asset, I'm not investing in it for a value realization. I'm investing in it to achieve a business purpose. And depending on what that business purpose is, it'll be managed differently, and it will result in different degrees of cash collection and or sales. And that helps in classification far more if I think about what the business purpose is. So in fair value net income, I'd have trading being the business purpose, where I'm going to go to the market to maximize value through sales. In fair value OCI, investing is the purpose with multiple objectives, duration matching, or liquidity risk management, et cetera. At amortized cost, financing is primarily the purpose. I'm not using lending because that's a very bank-specific for financing. But I think I'd be willing to accept some investing in amortized cost if the purpose of investing was to park money and assets to primarily cash collect on the rare circumstance that a regulator might make you to sell it in a liquidity problem. Okay. But note, I'm starting right away with what the objective or the business activity or model is and giving it a name that leads to how you manage it. Nowhere in there do I have a story about how how performance is being reported to management. I don't think it's important, and I think that's a red herring when you try to divide between fair value net income and fair value amortized OCI, because in those areas you're going to look at fair value both. So that's not going to be helpful in that sort of delineation whatsoever. But it is still driven from activity.
Okay.
So I'm trying to flip where we've been.
I'm not certain I'm going to dovetail exactly with Tom and Larry, but I think I'm directionally in the same place. I really appreciate where the staff is, direction. I think you've got a lot of good concepts in here. What I'm struggling with is this business purpose notion and the creation of value. So let me just see if I can build off of what's been already said and give you a very simple and I think a very realistic example. My business purpose is to serve clients, is to provide them not only lending but other services and things. So in my world, I look at it and say, who are my most profitable customers? Those most profitable customers, when they need financing, I am there to lend money to them and to hold for cash collection, because most of my customers don't want their loans floating out in the marketplace. So I am a, you know, originate and hold, and I'm doing that for my best customers. But at the same time, I've got certain risk metrics that I'm looking at. I can only have so many loans on my books of a certain credit quality, and I'm targeting a specific risk level. So now, in order to maintain that risk level and constantly serve my best customers, every quarter, I have 2 to 3% sales to create room to manage the risk in that portfolio. But my primary purpose is to serve my best customers. At the end of the year, I look at this and I have to, I think to Larry's point, I backward look at this and I say, well, at 2 to 3% sales per year, I have 10% sales this year. Where do I put those, that pool of loans? Where do I put my loans that I think from a business purpose is predominantly, primarily, hold to collect, but my real purpose is to serve my best customers and create value from serving my best customers? How do I think about this? And how do I apply what we've said in this memo to a situation that I think is reflective of a lot of business models out there?
I think you will have to look at the reasons why you were selling those good customers.
Well, very clear. I have certain targeted risk levels, and I'm always serving my best customers.
Right. He's constantly taking the bottom of his customer list and replacing them with better customers, and he sells out those poorer customers from which he expects not to make as much in other fees.
But I'm still serving my customer because I'm originating the loan, I'm doing my business model, but occasionally I can't hold that asset in my portfolio. I find another place for it. If they came back to me for another loan, I would still serve them or still find it. I just may not hold that loan because of my broader business model. Again, what I'm doing to create value for the entity as a whole.
So how I look at this kind of scenario is that I'm trying to invest in my good customers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm trying to invest in those customers so that I can generate income. I can maximize my yield. So I think it smells like an investing activity to me.
Well, you're focusing on yield for that particular. I'm looking at return on investment in that collective customer. You and I have talked offline. That lending relationship may be important, but it's in concert with others, like a treasury function, a cash management function, asset management functions that I may also serve them with. I'm looking at the collective relationship. The yield on this particular asset, this particular loan, may not be as great as something else.
So when I said yield, I was talking about yield from this customer. So how much money I can make from this customer by doing various things for this customer.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to maximize my return from investing in this relationship.
Correct.
Yeah. Maybe it's investing. My primary objective is to invest in things.
So
and when I believe that I have a good investment, so I have...
So this hold to collect portfolio, the predominant process here is to hold to collect, and I will still be holding those loans at the end when they come to pay off and refinance, whatever. I'll still be collecting those, but it would be in a fair value category.
No, but you would have, you might sell them. Like, if you get a good customer, then you are going to sell a customer. So there's no limit to which one you would sell. So you would continue to, you churn out your bottom customer. So, I mean,
I'm just trying to point out, I like the direction and concept, but I think when you try to apply it to the real world, I think you're going to get a lot of the second guessing. I think documentation will be, I can derive any answer here that I want based on what my objective is for the accounting.
Okay.
Words used. So I, like Larry, I do not have a quick fix for you, but this concerns me.
Okay.
Let me react for a second. What I just described was a model, our current model, that focuses too much on frequency of sales.
Mm-hmm.
Where I would rather turn it around to be able to say what is that the value realization and its mix is an outcome of the model, and if it's primary cash collection, vast majority cash collection, that's a different issue and those sales are okay. But note what the discussion always comes back to is the sale, are the sales okay?
And that's what I'm looking at. The cumulative effect of these sales in my example is 10% for the entire year. And you used a degrees of sales, I think, was or degrees of collection, reverse it, degrees of collection. So I collected on 90%, not on the remaining 10%. How will people look at this in interpreting what this rule means?
Well, that's what we're trying to be able to figure out here,
yeah,
and how to be able to do it better.
But using terms like creating value, I would argue I'm creating value predominantly through collection. I think I meet all this test for amortized cost. My concern is others would not agree with me here. And I personally would say in this business model that if you had 5% sales per period, per quarter, I would be okay with that. But I think others would not.
So. I'll try to be quick because I think a lot of the points have already been made, but we say in the memos several times sales don't drive the business model, and I think we can say it, but I don't think in practice that will be true. In the future memos, we go on to talk fairly significantly about what sales are or aren't okay. I think that's the point that Hal's making. It's the point that Tom's making, is we can say in one spot sales don't drive the model. I just don't believe that that's going to be the case in practice, and so I like the approach Tom is outlining as maybe a way to focus less on sales. I'm not sure whether that will ultimately bear out either, but it seems like it has, at least to me, more intrigue than a model that says sales don't drive it and then go on to talk about all the sales that you can and can't have. And I also have that similar, I guess, points to Martin and talk about reclasses and the impact of sales on past assessments versus future assessments, and wonder whether we're creating models based on an accounting construct versus business models. So you sort of look at your business, but you could have assets that are identical that you plan to manage in an identical way in two different categories depending upon when you purchased those assets. And so I think economically you would think I'm in one business model. But we've created an accounting construct that says if you bought it a year ago, you keep it in that model. And if you bought it today, you would consider sales differently and maybe put it in a different model. So not just identical assets being managed differently, being accounted for differently, but assets being managed similarly, accounted for differently. And I think that's an accounting construct of a model, not really a business model. And I wonder if Tom's approach might also respond to that.
Mark, you want to get back in? All right, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I'll be brief. I was just going to say that for me, I'm quite pleased with the direction here in this memo. I think that as compared to previous iterations from the staff, this is a giant improvement in clarification of how sales should be considered in the business model assessment, et cetera. And so, you know, unlike others, I'm not as troubled. I believe that this is a really highly judgmental area, and I don't think that we're going to be successful in trying to remove all judgment and all potential for second guessing. Now, I appreciate Larry's point that maybe there's some things we can do, you know, to make it more operable and more auditable to alleviate some of that. But I think that we're in a pretty good spot as far as I'm concerned with this, with maybe just a few more tweaks.
Matt, you want to make a point?
Yeah, I think one point I wanted to make was just getting back to house example. I just wonder if that is another example for whether we think the reclassification threshold is just too high, which is creating rigid accounting barriers. Will make it difficult for financial institutions to reflect actually how they manage their business and how sometimes those decisions will change in the future.
Mark? I look at Hal's example and think that perhaps, again, the objective is just not clear as opposed to it being a reclass issue. Any model that focuses, and I think why Tom was so focused on describing the objective as business activities as opposed to value realization, is that any model that focuses on day one about how you expect that you might realize it on day 365 is going to be subject to sales issues and reclassification issues by default. It has to be. There's no way that you're going to get around it if you focus on the objective being on day one figuring out what the value realization is going to be at the end of that instrument's life. And so what Tom's describing is focusing instead as the primary objective on what were the activities that originated the asset on day one. Okay? It's much more objective in terms of what are the activities that started out the instrument. Was it predominant? Was it a lending activity? Was it a credit underwriting decision? In Hal's case, in each one of those cases, it was a credit underwriting decision on day one, irrespective of whether a year from now, he decides, well, these are the top 20 customers, these are the top 50 customers, and it doesn't matter. On day one, it was an underwriting decision. That's going to be, you know, that's going to lead you down to the path of one particular model.
I just want to add, it wasn't solely a credit underwriting decision. It was a customer relationship decision. But Rahul's point, I'm looking at a relationship collectively. Underwriting was one aspect of that.
Okay. Well, then we got to define the activities. I'm trying to come up with a more objective way on day one to decide what the classification of an asset is going to be. And if I think about the activities that are happening concurrently on day one, I'm going to be able to have a judgment that's much easier to make and less subject to second guessing down the road than if I'm trying to figure out on day one what's going to happen at the end of the instrument's life.
But you're not saying that if you do credit underwriting, it's automatically in cost. In other words, are you?
Sure sounds it.
I'm saying that we need to focus on the activities that originated the instrument. We could decide what those activities were. What Tom was describing was a customer financing activity, okay, that leads ultimately to value realization.
Right,
But that's not the objective. The objective is to figure out the activities that are surrounding the instrument.
I'm not sure always underwriting leads to cash collection, but if it's underwriting with the objective of managing credit risk to collect cash over time as the primary thing, note that's the second part. It's the business activities, underwriting or financing. What are you doing with it? It's to collect cash over time to manage credit risk, so most of the time. But sometimes you could underwrite in a life insurance setting to end up investing on a long-duration asset to sell it. So it's underwriting to me is not definitive, but it's what is the reason you got into it? I think in the insurance setting for a loan, it's longer investing in a long-duration asset that you have to underwrite. But
it's about the activities on day one as opposed to figuring out what's going to happen at the end of it. And we could figure out what those activities are.
Let me try to just kind of tentatively test where I think we might be. Going back to paragraph 72 in the memo, I have heard that we, and correct me wrong, we generally agree with the concept in paragraph 72 A and B, but we think there needs to be some changes to the word. I've heard that the level in paragraph 73 and 74 we generally agree with. The issue that we are having a debate now, it really gets into paragraph 75A and what we mean by activity, and 75B and whether or not we want to at all consider whether or not how things are reported internally and externally is relevant. And then paragraph 75C that goes into 76 really talks about the point of documentation and the term all relevant information. Is that really what the debate is? Okay, so let me ask this with respect to Tom. Or do you want me to go ahead and call a vote, Hans? Or do you want to kind of test it, make sure we... you want to kind of test that at your board? Because I think the point here is about when we get into how we want to assess activity.
I think we have here felt that the board was generally supportive answers to both questions. Can I see whether that is the case?
Question one first.
Question one.
Christine.
Question two.
Fifteen.
Oh, okay. So just from a formality, who agrees with question one?
One of 16.
With the tweaks we're talking about, right?
So now with respect to question two, I think the key point here is when we discuss activity. So now I'm in 75, I think, A and B, and then also to some degree 76 A. A and B. We are not. I don't hear us saying that cells are determinative. Is that right? How are you looking comfortable?
I think that we're not trying. We're trying not to say that.
Right. So I just want to make sure.
I'm certain we're being successful.
I know. So let's make sure we can at least try to figure out the outcome we want, and then we can roll and the game will draft it. Right, Roel? Okay. So I don't think we're saying cells are determinative. I think what we're saying is that the business model should be based on activity. You should understand the activity when you get into something and when you get out of something. And as you get into it, you should understand what you expect to do with it. And then you should look at things like your historical activities. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, and if you end up engaging in activities subsequent to day one that are inconsistent with what you thought those activities were going to be, that might affect your future assessments of how to classify those very same types of assets going forward. But I don't think you go back, just go forward.
Well, but why doesn't it? So let's say you have assets that are similar and you sell some of them. Why doesn't that reflect a change in how you're managing the assets that you continue to hold? So it's the whole reclassification issue that's been brought up several times today.
Otherwise, I don't think it's really a business model. What we're saying is you make a determination, and then it gets locked into an arbitrary accounting box that stays the same, and you keep different states of assets in different boxes depending on when you bought them or when you sold.
So can we deal with reclassification separately? I just want to make sure. I think we need to get to that, and I think we need to talk about, do you reclass, and if so, when you reclass, and how significant of a change you need to reclass. But I want to first focus on our business model. You want to talk about reclass or your business model?
It's somewhere on the border, because okay. I wanted to point out that in my very simple example, what you would end up having to do is look at your profitability ranking by customer. And then, to Larry's point, as you create new loans that are in the lower tiers of profitability, even though today my intent is to hold because I've got capacity for them, it's higher probability that I would have to sell that loan. So those could never be classified as amortized cost or would have to be reclassified later.
I think we'd have to vote about that.
Well,
I have a concern that fair value is irrelevant in that setting.
Irrelevant?
Yes. Because if I do an amortized cost classification, it's saying fair value is not important in the statement.
Not as important.
It's not going to be in the totals, and it's not going to be in the income statement.
But it will be, at least parenthetically, on the face.
For only public entities.
Thank you for that reminder yet again.
To your point about reclassification consideration coming later, et cetera, I still think, though, that what we're voting on in question two, as the staff recommendation in paragraph 77, goes directly to what I was going to say in response to Larry's question, which is I think the staff's got it right with setting this as a high hurdle. In other words, the business model hasn't changed unless you're getting in or out of a whole activity.
Okay. I just want to make sure we have agreement on the business model, then I was going to deal with reclassifications. So I hear we think there should be some tweaks to the business model to make it clear that you need to consider why you're getting in and how you're going to realize the value. And that sales are not determinative, and we would place less emphasis on management reporting. Is that fair?
I'd add to it why you're getting into it, how you're going to create value through risk management, and then how you're going to realize value. Step in between.
Okay. How different do you think that is from literally the staff recommendation?
Because the way the staff has it, we're getting into all the issues about subsequent sales and reclassifications. And if you focus first on the activities on day one, then those activities that happened on day one don't change.
Okay, but I've taken reclassifications off the table for a second. So I think we need to determine how significant of a change in your philosophy causes reclassifications. But I thought, I read the staff recommendation to say sales are not determinative.
Russ, so it says that here, and then in the next memo, we're going to get into an entire discussion about permitted levels of sales. Russ, and I don't think you can look at this issue separate from the next.
Okay.
I actually don't have much trouble with the words that are here in paragraph 75. I just don't see them being applied in the way we're discussing them in the subsequent, the next memo.
So what you're really saying is we need to talk about the next memo?
So what I'm pulling in is the application of these words to the next memo and saying the reason you can't get into it can't be to collect cash. That's what the next memo says. The objective is to collect cash and the outcome is to collect cash. Business activities have to be different from what the value realization is going to be with the interim value creation and management in between. And so you can vote on this, and then if the staff could say, well, I've applied it in B, and I don't agree that they've applied it in B in the way I would read the word business activities being up front and important here and being separate from value realization.
Okay. So I think we kind of know what we're thinking, but I think what you're saying is we need B and C for the details. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Now, with respect to reclassification, I hear some concerns that what is recommended in 77 and 78 is not appropriate.
Are we agreeing that performance indicators are not all that important? That is in 75.
Yeah, I had thought that we were saying we would not place a significant amount of emphasis on that. Still something you wouldn't necessarily tell someone to just avoid, not consider. So what changes are people proposing to paragraph 77 and 78?
Well, I said that I would want to converge on the reclassification date on paragraph 78.
78. Okay, but
then on 76, I actually said that I didn't want to have 76 being in there, but I didn't hear anybody else pick that up.
Well, in terms of 76C, I certainly don't want the last phrase. As long as the entity considered all relevant and objective information as available at the time it made the assessment, because I think that's going to introduce huge opportunity for second guessing with hindsight bias that will just cause a consideration to say you didn't consider all the information, so you were in error in your classification.
I agree with that, particularly when the word is all in there. Pat talks about the level of documentation, how you would have documentation that would ever contemplate all available information.
So I agree with that, but I don't think you can just get rid of the last phrase. I think you have to get rid of all of 76C. Because it says it will not result in a restatement if you consider it all relevant. You can't just say it won't result in a restatement. You have to get all of 76C out. So who here would vote to remove 76C. Okay, that's five.
The only question I have is I'm trying to think through that in a way to say if we take it out, I mean, it's saying if cash flows are realized in a way that's different, and if we're going to take that out, then we're not saying if cash flows are realized in a way that's different, we're not saying what you do. So what do you do?
I think you basically have to prove and understand why it's different. Why did your realization change from that? What was the business thing that changed
I think it's consistent with A, to say sales don't drive the business model, then to have a test in C that says, well, sales drive.
There's no consequence.
So you're saying that removing C doesn't change the outcome. It just it makes it more clear.
It goes back to the point I was making at the start. Every business model we have will permit sales. This sort of suggests that any sales would call it in question immediately. And I think we have to change the focus off that. You have to evaluate whether the sales were consistent with the purpose or activity that you're doing. If it's different from that purpose and they're significant, then that would cause me to reassess whether I'm in that business model. But this one just says, look at sales. So if I sold for credit deterioration reasons out of an amortized cost model, that would be okay. If I sold because a regulator forced me to sell, that would be okay. To me, if I sold almost all at the very end when there's little or no cash flows to collect just so I don't have to hassle with collecting it, that might be okay.
Right.
This sort of says any sales, problem.
Right. I think I agree with what Jim said. A gives me comfort that it's being adequately considered, so I'm fine. I'll raise my hand.
Okay, so can we now focus on paragraph 77? I'll call a vote on 78 in a second, but on paragraph 77, do we want to have a change there, or is it okay to foster here?
I think that an existing asset ought to be classified the same way a current asset would be if you had the same characteristics and intended to manage it the same. And I think this is you don't. And so I'd like to have...
So it gives you... It effectively gives you permission, what Jim's suggesting is to give you permission to reevaluate whether there have been changes in circumstances such that you're now intending to
So would that mean that you could reclassify certain instruments within a business model without reclassifying the entire business model? That would be the end result of that?
Yeah. Ralph, both you and Larry are very difficult to hear for us, so please use the mic.
Okay. So you would do an instrument by instrument analysis, not a business model analysis.
Well, I the whole discussion. To me, you have to evaluate things on an instrument by instrument basis. When
right.
you first get into the model, as Mark indicated, you're evaluating on an instrument by instrument basis, and
right.
there might be times that you've effectively changed how you're going to manage one instrument or a series of instruments within a portfolio.
That's the key point. Is I think we all believe on day one you have to make an instrument by instrument analysis. The question is on day two, are you still doing instrument by instrument analysis, or are you doing a business model analysis?
I think you're still doing an instrument analysis, but on future new instruments based on the activity that might have happened with the ones you already had.
Right, but that's not what Jim's saying. Jim, I think what you're saying is you constantly do an instrument by instrument analysis.
I think you still see if that instrument fits in that business model. So I think this says it doesn't matter whether the instrument continues to fit in that business model anymore. Once you put it in there, you always keep it there. And
right.
my approach would say, no, if you have an instrument that you're no longer keeping in that business model, put it in the business model it belongs in.
Then you're going to have to rank the profitability of your customers.
So as I understand the staff's recommendation is you would put an instrument in business model cost, business model OCI, business model net income on day one. If you had a change in business model to the extent of you no longer had anything in amortized cost, you'd move the entire business model somewhere else. But you wouldn't do an instrument by instrument. You wouldn't take loan A and move it to OCI halfway through it. The other view is to say, no, you should constantly evaluate whether or not your intention of the instrument is consistent with the business model it's classified in. Right? Those seem to be the two views on the table.
I think it's just subsequent reassessment.
Right. It's what you're subsequently reassessing.
Every instrument you're reassessing.
Right.
As well as assessing business model to see if your business model changes. I think Jim's saying on day two you would reassess.
I actually think that...
Instrument by instrument, which I'm not sure is operable, but...
I think it adds complexity, frankly, the subsequent reassessment and potential reclassification of instruments you already hold. I don't disagree that perhaps it might be more accurate with your, as of that day, you know, business plan, but I think what the staff has proposed is a simpler answer.
Matt, I think, Jim, what you're saying is what's happening in GAAP today in the U.S., so let's keep that practice.
And I understand.
I sell half of my portfolio. I shouldn't keep it in
the cost bucket. I have a plan to sell it. Move it into trading.
Right.
Tom? I actually believe if that's what happens, we're not developing a model that really says there's ring-fenced business activities for these assets. I mean, that's what raises the problem. And I have serious concerns about that particular issue, but if we're going down the approach that there are separate and distinct and ring-fenced activities within entities, I think that's what I agree. I don't think it will happen very often that you would be changing it that frequently. But if it does, I think we'd have to go back and reclass.
Okay, so let me ask this question. By show of hands, who agrees with the underlying concept in paragraph 77, which is you're talking about a reclassification of the business model in its entirety? 1, 2, 3, 4. 4.5. Okay. Now, with respect to paragraph 78, we have a minor disagreement between the FASB and the ISB. Mark is proposing that he would be willing, for the sake of convergence, to move to to show this the beginning of the period following the reclassification. So who on the FASB agrees to change this to conform with the ISB? Do people know what the difference is? Okay, so that's...
Yeah, I prefer our
thumbprint. Okay, so that's 4. What? Okay.
It just seems inconsistent. I'm not going to object to the 4 voting to that for that, but it just seems inconsistent with the notion that there has really been a change in classification that period to wait to the next period.
Right, and you're taking that change out of context from what happened in the period before when the actual change was made.
Right.
You're complicating analysis, but I'm not going to.
I think you'll never have a change given what we voted on the first issue, so. And you'd have to eliminate a business model in its entirety. I think it'll happen.
No, it's better than reclassifying every asset every quarter.
Okay, so turn it back to you.
Okay.
Okay. Moving on to the next paper, agenda paper 6B. FASB memo number 250R discusses the hold-to-collect business model for the amortized cost measurement category. IFRS 9, the limited amendment CD, and the FASB's proposed ASU have a consistent notion of the hold-to-collect business model. That is, for financial assets to be measured at amortized cost.
Can you please speak up? You are very hard to hear. Thank you. That's better.
For financial assets to be measured at amortized cost, they must be held within a business model whose objective is to hold those assets to collect contractual cash flows. The staff analysis and discussion section of the paper is broken up into 2 subsections. The first subsection discusses potential clarifications and enhancements to the hold-to-collect business model. The second subsection specifically discusses the role of sales when assessing the hold-to-collect business model. Consistent with the staff recommendations in ISB Agenda Paper 6A and FASB Memo 249R, in order to improve the clarity of the guidance and assist preparers in applying the hold-to-collect business model assessment, the staff recommends that the board discuss and provide examples of the specific activities that are commonly associated with the hold-to-collect business model and that are aimed at achieving the objective of that business model, and provide guidance on the nature of the information an entity should consider in assessing the hold-to-collect business model. Paragraph 45 of this paper provides examples of activities the staff believes would be commonly associated with the hold-to-collect business model, while paragraphs 47 through 49 describe the nature of the information the staff believes an entity should consider in assessing a hold-to-collect business model. With respect to the role of sales out of the hold-to-collect business model, the staff recommends that the board's emphasize that insignificant and or infrequent sales are not inconsistent with the hold-to-collect business model, regardless of the reason for such sales. The staff also recommends that the boards do not quantify the notions of infrequent and insignificant sales, and instead clarify that determining whether sales are insignificant and or infrequent is a matter of judgment and would be based on facts and circumstances. In addition, the staff recommends that the boards clarify that historical sales information and patterns could provide useful information and evidence about how an entity currently manages its financial assets and how cash flows will be realized and value will be created, but such sales information should not be considered in isolation and is not determinative. The staff also recommends that the boards clarify that credit risk management activities aimed at minimizing potential credit losses due to credit deterioration are integral to the hold-to-collect business objective. Some staff members recommend stating in the guidance that sales of financial assets due to credit concentration risk, such that the financial assets no longer meet an entity's documented investment policy or credit risk management protocols, should be considered consistent with the objective of holding to collect contractual cash flows. Other staff members believe that sales made in managing credit concentration risk should be assessed in the same way as any other sales made in the business model. That is, an entity needs to assess whether the asset's credit quality is deteriorated, and if so, such sales would be consistent with the hold-to-collect business model. If not, an entity would need to assess the nature, frequency, and the volume of sales in assessing whether they are consistent with the hold-to-collect business model. The paper has two questions for the boards, and I'll turn it over to the boards for discussion.
Okay, you want us to start, Hans?
Yes, okay, you're all.
Okay, who wants to start? Tom, you want to start?
I can.
All right.
My biggest concern about the staff recommendations are the self-fulfilling prophecy of the objective or the activity being cash collection and the realization being cash collection. I think that's just going to exacerbate the focus on any sales being a problem and an ex post hindsight view of evaluating whether the classification was correct. So I would encourage that a separate business activity be what would be identified that would lead to certain risks or asset management that would lead primarily to, or the vast majority being cash collection. And so I think you've described in this memo three different scenarios where you feel comfortable with amortized costs, and we have to decide whether we're comfortable with all of them. I may be so. I mean, the first one would be if you are doing customer financing or financing activities where you're underwriting with the purpose to collect principal and interest. So the business activity is financing or underwriting financing. The way you're going to manage that financing activity is in this subset of assets is to collect the principal and interest, right? To do that, you got to manage the credit risk to maximize your ability to collect principal and interest. That leads to the primary way of realizing value will be collecting cash flows with sales being permitted in areas to manage that credit risk. Credit deterioration is particularly comfortable for me. Credit concentration is not, only because I think you can always say any sale changes your credit concentration, so it just opens it up too much. So I like your paragraph 70, what is it? Paragraph 62. D2 solution, that it be evaluated in terms of frequency, frequency or infrequency, etc. I like your don't have to evaluate if it's either infrequent or the magnitude small. Your recommendation in paragraph B of 7062 doesn't put the parentheticals that you have in paragraph 58. I like that. But then let's move on to your other two scenarios. The other two scenarios were regulatory-driven sales. The purpose of the entity, the business activity of that entity, is to invest in assets as required by the regulator to be available if the regulator would require you to sell it for liquidity reasons. But your intention in investing in those things are basically to cash collect them out. In the rare circumstances or infrequent circumstances, perhaps you'd have to sell it.
Now, if the regulator says you always have to sell it to show you can sell it, that'd be a different story. But if you could say that you're investing in them and you're really basically holding them to cash collect till the rare happenstance occurs, I think you could end up saying that that's an amortized cost sort of circumstance. But again, I'm putting caveats around that. You changed around, the regulator says you got to get into it and you have to be able to sell these every year and a portion of every year to prove that you can sell them. That doesn't seem to me that the value realization is going to be both collecting and selling.
But if you buy them with the understanding that if the regulator says sell them, you'll sell them, and those are the ones you'll sell, I don't understand why you're supporting amortized costs.
Because I think that's going to be infrequent. So the vast majority of the time you're going to cash collect, but I think you'd have to make that judgment. And we could have a conversation about that. Same thing you said about I underwrite to cash collect, but when it gets to the very end of these things, instead of trying to cash collect out the very final ones and doing it, I just sort of sell them all at that point. I might be willing to consider that also if it's maximum is cash collect, if you're collecting virtually all the cash flows. And those sales there is just a cleanup mechanism to not have to be chasing down the absolute last dollars in the portfolio in different ways. But that would be business activities, risks that you're undertaking, and then and value creation and methods of managing those assets leading to not only the predominant one, but the reasons you would sell. And that's different. So that's what I would feel comfortable with.
Anybody else? Okay, I'll turn it over to you, Han.
I agree with the staff recommendation in both of these paragraphs. I think it makes sense, particularly the question to the question two. I don't think there's any need to have any special treatment of the concentration of credit risk, because I think, as you say, you can assess it in the same way you would any other sales in the business model. So I think it preserves the integrity of the model without creating special exceptions. I conclude on this paper, I want to test whether or not I have the same understanding as the FASB as to what we mean by the fair value OCI business model, the amortized cost business model. And the way I'm looking at this is that business model is just another term for the classification category that we're using. Business models, in my view, are determined or differentiated by the investment objectives. And investment objectives are essentially determined by what is your desired investment outcome. So in a business model for amortized costs, your investment outcome, your desired investment outcome, is an effective or constant yield over the life of the asset. So hence holding to collect is consistent with that approach. For the fair value OCI business model, your desired investment outcome is a total return, meaning you're desiring to get price appreciation, so therefore you're willing to sell, and you're also desiring a constant return, so therefore, or yield, therefore I'm willing to hold to collect. But I'm essentially engaging in both of those activities. In a business model employing trading or fair value through P&L, there I'm focused almost exclusively or primarily on price appreciation. So therefore, I'm very much engaging in trading activities. So I think we need to distinguish, words are everything here, obviously, distinguish what a business model is. A business model represents effectively an investment objective which carries with it desired investment outcomes. And there are certain activities that I might engage in. There are also certain constraints. So, for example, if I have to observe a constraint around liquidity, that may affect the activities I engage in. But it doesn't change my objective, which in the fair value OCI category, for me, is total return. Okay, I'm looking to get return from both collecting as well as through selling price appreciation. So I when I listened to the conversation on the first paper, I thought I was on the same page primarily with Tom, and I just want to confirm or test that. The second thing that I just wanted to come back to was the issue in 76C, in my mind, is critical, because if you don't have any kind of test, if you will, as to whether or not you're actually making a bona fide or faithful representation of your business model, then you're not effectively going to, I think, have a useful set of financial statements, because you can pretty much do anything you want. You can say one thing and do anything you want, and there's no consequence of that. And I think we're giving an awful lot of safe harbors, an awful lot of comfort to the reporting entity about what they can actually do that won't disrupt their business model, provided that all of those activities were contemplated in the context of when you actually set up the business model. So yes, you can sell for credit deterioration, and you can sell perhaps for other types of activities too, when you have a credit concentration that represents a credit deterioration. But essentially, just engaging in a whole lot of selling when you said at the outset you weren't, in my mind, doesn't make any sense, and to allow no change or reassessment of the business model. So I just throw that out because I think there needs to be some clarity around what these terms mean, and that's essentially what I interpret them to mean.
Anybody?
No. So the last sentence, 73C, oh no, the last paper. So you want to change the measurement category for the current holding, the remaining holding. And the
I think
that
Pat
was agreeing
with
what was
in the
paper.
Exactly.
In other words, that's what the proposed. Okay.
Do we agree with
the statement?
Oh, sorry,
Stephen.
Can I just
clarify
where
fail-filtry
reasons come in
there? So my understanding is if evaluated as with everything else, same basis.
Yeah. No special rules.
It's just the
world.
Just listening to the discussion in the SASB about both this paper and previous paper, I guess I have some sympathy with Jim's concern that if we say it's not all about sales and then we go on and have a paper about what sales are okay with or not, I think it goes, however, more to how we might communicate some of these comments and observations, because being realistic, sales are what stress the assertion of amortized cost business model. You know, if you're going to hold it to collect, sales are the activity that stress that assertion. So I think it's, even though we say in support that sales are not determinative, I think we do have to spend some time commenting on them, but we should do it in a way that acknowledges why we feel a need to have some commentary about it without leaving the impression that it sounded like Jim got, which is we're saying sales aren't determinative, and then we're going to spend all our time talking about why they really are.
I think what we mean is, if sales occur, that does not automatically mean you cannot be in amortized cost. That's what we say.
Right.
But obviously, you can. It's not a free-for-all, and you can sell whatever you want.
And in that free-for-all, you can. You know, it's not a free-for-all. You can sell whatever you want as the parameter. In paper 6B, I did pause for a minute when we had the discussion around. When you sell for credit deterioration, and I understand the point that people say, if I'm holding to collect, I don't want to have to hold something that I can see going bad, and I don't want to have to wait until there's objective evidence of impairment, and I don't want to have to wait until I've seen significant credit deterioration if I spot something happening. But I think we need to do something more than just say, as long as, you know, your explanation for why you have a sale is because I was concerned about the credit. I think it has to be a bit tighter than that without trying to change the staff's recommendation that sales for credit purposes do not call into question holding to collect. It comes across now as a bit of a free pass. That's the play this card, get out of jail free. And I think it's actually more a legitimate reason, but it has to tie back to how you do that management. And I think it's probably more a documentation.
Yeah, I think we can do work on that.
Yeah, just on a different point, I'm in agreement with question one. But question two gives us a choice, doesn't it? We go to point one or point two.
I'd go with the two.
Nothing special for credit deterioration.
With credit deterioration or credit contemplation?
First of all, who agrees with the question? You want to come in, PK?
Yes, I just wanted to say because there is some momentum building against the credit contemplation. I raised this issue last time also. I feel that we need to think through a little bit more carefully rather than putting it in the general hopper to say all credit concentration should be viewed only until the deterioration happens. I think, like I said last time, an example, the two companies merge and I hold the assets of both the companies, two bonds of two companies, and I put them in amortized cost, but I don't have any reason to hold beyond certain percentage of my total portfolio, and it has gone beyond that. And so why should I wait for that somebody to mark them down for me to sell it to, if I have a documented policy that I don't hold certain percentage beyond that? So I feel that, I think given all the logic that we have given, and I completely agree with whoever wrote the 62D1, I think that's a very fair conclusion there. And I don't, so I, to that extent, for the second question, I support the credit concentration to be one of the criteria to be thought about.
Although on your specific example, PK, if you had a personally, I haven't spoken to the other staff about this, but personally, if you had a situation where because of an acquisition you thought that in the near term to sort of get your portfolio straight in terms of what you wanted your overall exposure to be, you were going to sell to rebalance things, if you like, I think that I'd probably argue that isn't really your business model. That's sort of a short-term rejigging, but it's not your overall business model. So I think that specific point maybe we could deal with.
Yeah, I mean, just to clarify, I mean, we're not saying that sales due to credit concentration fail, and they automatically mean that you can't be at amortized cost. What we're saying is they're different from sales due to credit deterioration, so you have to think. You have to think about it, just as you would have to think about any other sales out of amortized cost.
Yeah, but there is a slight difference, though, in my mind, because if you sell it because of that, are you putting it in the general category to calculate whether they are frequent, infrequent? So it goes against the threshold that, you know, some people keep a tab on it. So I'm just saying that this looks like if it is a documented policy and you do it because of that, and it's an even outside your control entirely, I just feel that this is very much in terms of the principle of maximizing the cash flows and minimizing the credit losses. And you don't need to wait for somebody to tell you there's a deterioration. And I just feel that, I know there will not be many words for that, but I just feel that I think we are being inconsistent in my mind.
The five views will be the same as they were last month's meeting. I support 62D1, but not 62D2, which is selling because of concentration against a documented risk policy. First of all, I think there's a number of free passes in here that, irrespective of, you know, low volume of sales, I think documented risk policy or documented investment policies, one, they can change. Two, they're often expressed as ranges. I think in dynamic portfolios, there's enough organic activity, both maturities and buying new business, that can allow you to get back inside your investment range. So I would support 62D1, but I think 62D2 is too much of an open pass.
Martin, and then I would like to come to the
right way around.
You're the other way around, then, Gary.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm in favor of 62D1, but not D2.
But
D1 is the pass.
Well,
the
one is the pass.
Okay, then I'm basically the backwards.
So,
with credit concentration, because I also think if a company is managing really this amortized cost portfolio and want to collect contractual cash flow, then based on credit risk, they have to shift portion of the portfolio, which is more than an insignificant portion of that portfolio. Isn't that really in line with collecting cash flows? Because if the company is not doing that, maybe the risk that they would not see the cash flows because they are deteriorated is also maybe not a good indicator for user from amortized cost information, because the cash flows have disappeared maybe. And therefore, I think it is a little bit different to other kind of sales if the intention is really to protect the cash flows, and if you have indications that maybe they will, in quality, the credit quality will go down, and then you take actions which will result in this. And so I'm not so sure if really that we should see it as any other kind of sale. Because as I said, the consequence if they're not doing that, maybe it will never be again the cash flows, and if that is in line with
to collect cash flows and all the
can I first see who agrees with the recommendation in question one? And then in question two, who agrees with paragraph 62D1?
Exchange 4.
And the others are in favor of 62?
12.
You, Russ.
Daryl, you had a question?
Yeah, actually, PK made my point. I was just going to state my preference for D1, but PK made all the relevant points I would have made.
Tom?
Pat asked for a response. So it's generally, Pat, I think I'm comfortable with much of what you said, other than the point that the objective is a constant yield, because I'm not sure that's the objective of investing in assets. Sometimes you invest in variable rate assets. Sometimes you're going to see that people hedge the risks in certain assets at different points in time. They get different returns. It might be yield management, but constant yield I don't know if I feel real comfortable about. And I'd still back it up to thinking about the activity that yields an objective of constant yield, because liquidity risk management probably doesn't have to deal with yield. Duration management may have to deal with yield. So there may be different dimensions, but generally speaking, I was comfortable with what you're talking
about. Okay.
Yeah.
More of a question for the staff. Assuming that we go with D2, there's going to be a sale with deterioration. In the impairment project, we have a roll-forward schedule that shows loans held, and one of the items that's required to be disclosed is sales. But we also have a roll-forward in the allowance, but we do not break out sales and changes in the allowance that relate to sales. Is there any consideration of the staff to link a vote with D2 to the roll forward, and then that would make this whole package tie together much, much better? You already have the roll forward disclosing sales. Here you're saying deterioration. That would say then if you know that there is deterioration and you know there is a sale, what impact of that did that have on loan loss reserve? And I think that would give you a more complete package if you tied that in. It's not tied today, but ask the staff to at least look at that, and either you all or the impairment team bring that back as an issue.
The deterioration is relevant for D1 and D2, right? The distinction is concentration.
Yeah, I think all staff agree that sales for credit deterioration are okay, or get the free pass.
Isn't the distinction, though, that in D2, consider sales for concentration have to be considered in light of whether there has also been deterioration, versus in D1, you don't have to consider deterioration. Sales for concentration are fine on their face, period.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, as PK was describing, that's why I thought D1 was better, because I don't see that as being inconsistent with holding to collect.
I think there's more emphasis on D2. You're right, but in the roll forward in the impairment project doesn't distinguish. It just says all sales. So you would have even more information if you had all sales in the relationship on the impact. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It'd be even more important under D1 because it'd be even more potential sales.
And it's even broader. Yeah.
Okay, so with respect to the first question, do we agree with the staff recommendation 62A through C to clarify cash flow realization concept, and then do we agree that this is the best way to do this? Recognizing that we previously said sales are not determinative, but there's a lot of emphasis there on sales. So who agrees with the staff's recommendation?
Is the recommendation to move off of saying that the objective is cash flow collection and the outcome is cash flow collection? I mean, if we go back to what we said in the first paper, that the objective would have to be identified with the business activity tied to risk management, et cetera. Because the examples here all are in this paper that the objective or the activity is cash collection. That's going to put far more stress on any sales.
Well, it's written in the concept of the objective is cash flow realization. It's not written in the concept of what we had talked about at the last minute. But yet, embedded within the concept of the last minute, cash flow realization is something to consider in the activity.
So I can vote concept, directionally towards what's happening right. In 62 as long as it's responsive to the issues that we raised in the last memo.
Okay.
To distinguish business activity differently, just like you did in the fair value OCI memo.
In other words, the objective shouldn't be solely value realization.
Right. And it should be. So in the fair value OCI, you sort of say the activity was investing either for liquidity management or duration management or yield, right? That's what you talked about. And that would and to do liquidity, duration, or yield, the outcome would be you either have to sell or cash collect to achieve those objectives. That results in a value realization of both possibilities. I think you'd have to do the same sort of linkage here.
The only point I was making was that embedded within what we talked in the last one was cash flow realization was a thing to consider in the activity, right?
Yeah, it was the outcome of the activity.
So in that context, do we agree with the additional application? When do we think it's necessary? And if so, under that objective, is this the kind of thing we want to put in there to help describe what we mean by the cash flow realization aspect? That's really what I'm trying to get at.
And my answer would be no.
No.
We need more. We need to start off with activities and risk yielding it, because that's not what's demonstrated here.
I know, but that's not what it was ever designed to do. So in other words, what you had changed the recommendation from the prior. We can either not deal with this and deal with all, or we can at least deal with this component of that recommendation. In other words, you broadened it at the last thing of beyond just cash flow realization. So we could either bring it all back at a future meeting and talk about activity, risks, realization, or we could solve realization today and talk about activities and risks. That's what I'm getting at, is recognizing this is not, in our minds, a complete package. It at least solves the problem, or may solve the problem related to realization.
All right. So all we're doing is evaluating if realizations are different than what the activities would suggest when they bring it back and the risk being managed, how we would deal with it in this memo.
Right.
I am very comfortable with B being the backstop. Don't give them very many free passes, but B being the backstop, that is, judge insignificant or infrequent to be able to evaluate whether they're really consistently following through. C seems to be very sales focused. And
how is B not sales focused too?
Well, you're getting a free pass if it's insignificant. If you insert the paragraph 58 parens, which I assume the staff would say that they want in here, because the paragraph 58 parens say sales are insignificant even if frequent, as long as cumulatively they are insignificant, and or infrequent even if significant. I thought you just failed to extend what you had in 58 to that example. That's they're saying there's a limited free pass. You don't have to do a lot of judgment and thinking.
Right.
That's the backstop. And then the other things we're doing here is saying, clarifying for certain business activities that things are consistent, sales are consistent with that business activity, even if they're beyond this. And I think that approach is reasonable, but it's very limiting.
Mark? I'm okay with what you have here under the caveats that you set it up. I think it's going to end up, to the extent that we're successful in building the activities on day one that get you into the right model, I think this might end, some of the sales stuff might end up being belts and suspenders that you don't even need as much. So I'm comfortable with it. On the credit concept, were you just doing the first question or the second question?
Go ahead with the second question.
Second question, I agree that customer concentration should not get a separate assessment in of itself. I would think of credit concentration just like any other. So I guess that's two.
Okay, so let me try. With respect to question one in the context of providing additional clarity around cash flow realization, who agrees with what's in 62A through 62C? So that's seven. With respect to question two, who in dealing with credit concentration, who is supportive of what is in 62D? You guys voted for D2 over there? Okay.
Yes.
Who believes paragraph 62D2 that would draw a distinction between credit deterioration and credit concentration?
No, was that what?
So yeah, deterioration is okay for sales. Concentration is not automatically so, is what he's saying.
You're surprising me. I thought you wanted 62D1. You wanted two? You do want a distinction between deterioration and concentration? So if you sell for concentration, you have to take it back to infrequency. Okay. Okay, that's fine. I thought your statement was you let me believe something else. That's okay. I might have missed it. Okay. That's 4-3.
4-D2.
Okay.
No, that's safer.
Okay, so with that, we'll move into the third and last paper for this meeting. The third paper for today's meeting discusses the hold-to-collect and sell business model that results in measurement at fair value OCI and the residual category that results in measurement at fair value P&L. As noted earlier, the business model assessment received overall support from the constituents. Therefore, similar to earlier papers, this paper also does not recommend any fundamental changes to the two fair value categories, but rather discusses clarifications that can be made in response to the feedback received. The background section of the paper provides an overview of the proposed guidance for both hold to collect and sell and the residual category, and the feedback section of the paper summarizes the feedback received on both fair value categories. The first section of the staff's analysis and recommendation discusses retaining fair value OCI as the measurement category and highlights that the staff continues to believe that a fair value OCI measurement category is necessary in order to properly classify and measure financial assets that are acquired or originated for activities which result in both holding to collect contractual cash flows and selling. Therefore, the staff recommend that the boards retain the fair value OCI measurement category. With regards to whether fair value OCI should be the residual category rather than being a defined category, the staff recommends that fair value OCI should be retained as a defined measurement category since it provides useful information for business models where both collection of contractual cash flows and the realization of cash flows through sales are integral to achieving the objective. As discussed in the paper, the staff believes that neither amortized cost nor fair value OCI would be useful as a residual measurement category, and consistent with the board's discussions last year leading to their respective exposure drafts, the staff also continues to believe that defining fair value P&L would be difficult and may allow entities flexibility in determining whether financial assets would be classified at fair value through P&L or fair value OCI. The second section of staff's analysis and recommendations discusses clarifications to the proposed application guidance for both the fair value OCI and fair value P&L categories. With regards to the fair value through P&L category, the staff recommends that even though the category is the residual category, its application guidance should be clarified to state that financial assets that are managed and evaluated on a fair value basis or those that are held for trading must be measured at fair value through P&L. In addition, the staff recommends that the application guidance should clarify that for assets classified in residual category of FVPL, an entity makes decision based on changes in and with the objective of realizing the asset's fair value. With regards to the fair value through OCI category, the staff recommends that the board clarify that managing financial assets to both collect contractual cash flows and for sale is the outcome of the way in which assets are managed rather than an objective in itself. The assets that are classified in fair value through OCI category are managed by both collecting contractual cash flows and selling to achieve an objective such as liquidity management, interest rate risk management, yield management, or duration mismatch management. Both collection and sales are integral to the performance of the fair value through OCI measurement category, and there are no thresholds for the frequency or amount of sale in this category. The example of activities that are typically associated with the fair value through OCI business model include holding the assets in a liquidity portfolio, matching the duration of financial assets to that of the liabilities they are funding, maintaining a particular yield profile or managing exposure to interest rate risk by holding and selling financial assets in accordance with the stated risk management policy, and monitoring key performance indicators of such financial assets through contractual interest yield and impairment charges and the fair value changes. All the staff recommendations are summarized in paragraph 74 through 76 of the memo. The two questions that the staff would like to ask today is that do the boards agree with staff recommendation to retain two fair value measurement categories, that is fair value through OCI and fair value through P&L, with fair value OCI as a defined category and fair value through P&L as a residual? And secondly, do the board agree with staff recommendation to clarify the articulation of fair value through OCI and fair value through P&L category? With that, I will turn it over to the board for discussion.
Larry? So I'd like to ask the staff a question. Effectively, with your summary of what a company looks at for fair value through P&L, do you view that as being effectively a fair value option for assets? If a company tracks and evaluates a particular instrument at fair value, but might hold it because they think they're going to realize gains or what have you, or trying to seize an opportune time to sell it. I mean, isn't that pretty close to a fair value option? And I'm not being...
We are
not that I'm opposed to that at all.
We had one in our model that if you're a fair value OCI, you had an option to go to fair value net income. We already had it in the model.
Okay. But I guess Larry's real question is,
my question is
the way it's written, the guidance is such that I think it's a fair value option, and I'm fine with that. But I just want to make sure other people agree with that.
You want to make sure we continue with a fair value option?
Yeah, I do. Okay. For assets.
Yeah, okay. Good clarification. I knew that's what you meant.
But we would do that explicitly as opposed to implicitly?
We had that in the ED. The question is, was the staff thinking about changing that recommendation? Or
We would bring a paper separately on that issue.
Okay. So they'll bring that separately? Okay.
Tom?
I just think it's important that there be one for insurance companies in particular.
And is that because that you could literally read this and you would be in fair value OCI, but you want them to have the opportunity to be fair value net income?
Because I think we're going to have to, in the insurance, they're going to be asking whether they could have an option to go through, put the OCI changes into net income.
Okay. Any other questions here? Okay, over to you, Hans.
Okay, it's over to you, Ian.
Over to you, Ian.
Just temporary rest, don't get worried. Any comments on this part of it? Stephen, you're here.
Well, you will know that our objective to this, when it was first proposed, and nothing has happened since then to make me change my mind. In fact, I'm even more opposed to it now. Somebody mentioned earlier about the link with insurance and that we're going to defer that. I don't quite understand that, given that this is so closely tied in with insurance. I'm not sure that even if I was in favor of it, I would be able to make a decision now absent further discussions on insurance. So what exactly are we doing on this with insurance?
We will look at the interaction, and it ties in with the comments that you've received from some, that you have a liability-driven business model, and that is mainly for insurance entities that have that. And so we will look at that interaction between how they account for the assets and their liabilities, you know, quite separate from the overall classification and measurement of assets.
So is the decisions we think now tentative, pending further discussions on insurance?
No, I don't think. I think we should consider all of our decisions are always tentative. Fishing that aside, I think we should consider these to be the decisions that we make with the potential for something specific further to be done to deal specifically with insurance contract accounting.
Okay.
And it's not a big, we're talking about, I think, targeting January, so it's not as though, you know, it's 6 months down the track. So it's before we finalise this document.
Okay, I won't take up too much time, but can I just go to page 30 and example 3 right at the end? Because what I've always been confused about is whether, when we talk about holding to collect and sell, does it matter what the reason for the sale is? Because when we describe the business model, we talk about liquidity management, interest rate management, yield management, duration management. And that's kind of reflected in example 3, where in paragraph 6, selling activity to rebalance the portfolio. What if the selling activity was simply because I thought that an asset was overpriced in the market? So I sell it, and I go out and buy another asset that's underpriced in the market. Do I still get fair value OCI?
Yes, if that was always your business model.
Okay. So my next question is, so what does my P&L tell me in that case? Does amortized cost in the P&L really give me any relevant information about this business activity? It seems to me that it doesn't. And yet, in our conceptual framework, we talk about profit and loss being the primary measure of performance. Now, surely you should put in the P&L what really tells me about the performance of the activity. And if I'm doing opportunistic purchases and sales to take advantage of price movements, what I get from a more time cost measurement in the income statement doesn't really seem to tell me very much about what that entity is doing.
Unless you're someone who thinks realization matters, and obviously there are some that think that.
Well, if realization of what matters, then we would extend the use of either a amortized cost or fair value or OCI more widely, wouldn't we?
Get the same P&L in both cases.
Two observations. First, I agree with the staff recommendation. First observation is in paragraph 76A. I think the clarification that you're recommending here is absolutely essential and critical. You're making the distinction in terms of saying that managing financial assets, both to collect contractual cash flows and for sale, is the outcome. And I think that's absolutely critical for an understanding of what we mean by fair value to OCI, and that was the point I was driving at earlier. Second point is in 76E, and this one kind of ties into an observation that Tom made, and I when I read this, I had a similar concern. It says, the board clarified the application guidance to state that there's no threshold for the frequency or the amount of sales. So let's just say for discussion, I have a fair value to OCI category, and I'm basically turning it over 95-99%. It seems to me that it calls into question, you know, is that really fair value OCI or fair value P&L? And your rationale for this is you say rather the entity will need to determine whether both collection and sales are integral. Well, the only way you can, I think, make that assertion safely is to have evidence to that effect. So if there's no threshold, then you can basically you know, do as much trading as you want, I think it's going to be very hard to then make that assertion. So it comes back to the point I was making earlier with the FASB on the difference between, you know, amortized cost and fair value to OCI. Without absolutely any requirement for some kind of evidence or documentation, then the whole thing is a free-for-all. So I guess I'm making the same observation here, that there needs to be some evidence that it is in fact integral to achieving that objective. Otherwise, there's no value to the assertion.
Overall, I support the specific recommendation, but contrary to Pat, looking at paragraph 76A, although I understand the second sentence, but the first sentence, I read it many times, I'm really struggling with what it means. It seems to me to be very circular when we say it is clear that managing the asset is the outcome of the way you manage. It seems to be very circular kind of reasoning.
The way I would look at it, Philippe, is the objective in my mind in a fair value through OCI category is a total return. So that's the objective, and the outcome of that objective is to hold the collect and the sell.
Yeah.
So that's the way I distinguish the two.
That's okay. Exactly what we mean. That's the way it's written here. It's pretty clear. I didn't have an answer to that.
Okay, Tom?
Like Steve, I wasn't very supportive or actually negative to this proposal, and I don't think that the arguments that we had when we made the proposal has really carried through. We made this because of insurance. I've learned from the insurance project that this solution doesn't serve the purposes for the insurance industry. We will have to do something else to keep the insurance industry healthy. And the small problems we had with some banks, I never really understood it, and I would live without it. So I maintain my opinion that this is without motivation to do.
Daryl?
I think I'm probably repeating a little bit of what I said last month when we talked about it. I think for me, the decision, when we took the original decision to have this third category, was about the fact that I believe there is a third business model out there. It is a genuine business model that is different to a hold-to-collect business model and different to a trading business model. And I think this appropriately reflects the fact that when you're looking at that third business model, the business model where hold-to-collect is one of the objectives, but so is realization through sale. This reflects both pieces of information that allows the user of the financial to get access to the information. I've perhaps had a slightly different experience in what I've heard from the insurance research that we've done. I don't think that this is the ultimate and only solution for insurance, but I think it has a place or part to play in the insurance solution. But for me, as I say, my decision wouldn't have been about insurance. My decision in coming to this, to supporting this approach, was in effect that I think there is a business model out there.
Wait, go.
No, I support the category.
No, from the beginning, I never feel this is only the issue. And secondly, and if related to insurance, I think the original idea to have this is for cash management purposes, you know, rather than the problem now will come out is the accounting mismatch of in income statement. I think from beginning, you know, why the insurance have this kind of, you know, category is for, I think, cash management. So they hold cash, but sometimes sell to meet their cash requirements. This is what I want to say, you know, current problem is related to income statement. But from the beginning, when we discussed why the insurance company have this one, it's mainly for cash management purposes.
Steven?
I just want to ask a question of Pat. You said about total return, manage the total return. If total return is what's important, why put only part of the total return in the income statement?
I think we've made a decision to provide a solution. You could argue it's not the most elegant to separate the components of that total return in profit loss and OCI. Some would prefer it all be in one place. Some prefer it to be, for example, all in OCI. Some prefer it to be all in T&L. We've elected to separate it. But it's transparent. It's available. You can see it. And I think you can make your own judgment, ultimately, as to what use you make of it.
Yeah, I suppose on this last month, too, there were three reasons were in the papers last month, three reasons why we're doing this: convergence, insurance, and better information, more useful information. I'm in favour of convergence, so if we could get somewhere along there, we could move with that. If it is really useful insurance, in insurance, then that's, it seems to be, to be tested and demonstrated to us, then that would be another reason for me agreeing with it. The useful information is based on the realization principle that's going to drop a whole lot of... I agree with you, Darrell, that there's another model. I just don't think this is going to give you useful information about that model at the end of the day, and I'm with Stephen. And that would sway me the other way, so I've got two out of three to balance. In the meantime, I'd be in favour of continuing with the process so that we leave that choice open to ourselves.
Gary?
I also agree with the staff's recommendation, largely along the lines of what Darrell is, but trying to step back and be a little more practical about the three models. Yes, I do think there's three models, maybe there's even more, but three for now. Is you've got the amortized cost method, which says I'm never going to realize capital gains. That's the general thrust of it. And then you've got the fair value through P&L thing model, which says I intend to get appreciation out of it. So go to the middle bucket, well, I may or may not sell it. If I do sell it, I don't know when it will be. So just sort of step out as financial instruments and look in whether it's revenue recognition or sale of assets. You would not be booking gains or losses, you would certainly not gains, with that degree of uncertainty about when, if, and how I'm going to realize it. So I would think that in itself is a reason why I think this third model, second bucket, you know, makes some sense.
Can I see who can work staff recommendation? Russ, did you already vote?
No, we did not. We need to vote. Tom, do you have a comment before we vote?
I have three little tweaks that I think that I'd like to suggest before we vote. In paragraph 76, there's a reliance on whether the assets are managed and evaluated on a fair value basis and performance metrics. I don't find that productive, because if you go to paragraph 77D1, they're also talking about fair value being important as a performance indicator for fair value OCI. They're adding other ones that impairment and or contractual yield might be important, but I think contractual yield can be important in a trading bucket too in deciding how to do so. So I don't find it productive and useful to have the performance indicator stuff in there, and I would recommend that that goes away. That doesn't mean I don't think the words that assets either help for trading or the entity making decisions based on changes in fair value with the objective of realizing the asset's fair value. I think those are good words. I just don't think managing on a fair value basis is going to help us. So I would suggest getting rid of that in both 77D1 and 76. And I agree with Stephen when we get to 76F and we talk about frequency of sales at a fair value OCI not being a problem. I think to be perfectly consistent with the whole package, we ought to end that paragraph by stating that if assets are held for trading or for the entity to realize value for sales, that those are not consistent with a fair value OCI category.
Yeah, Larry. So if we have a fair value option, then I don't care about your recommendation. I go along with it. If we don't, then I have concerns with it, because what happens if you hold a fair value, an option? What if you hold an asset and you want it fair value through P&L, but you never sell it? Does that preclude you from...
Actually,
I thought the managed and evaluated on a fair value basis
would enable you to classify as fair value P&L an asset and not call into question that classification even if you did not sell it.
What I'm raising, Larry, is if you look at fair value OCI and the guidance and performance indicators, it also says it's managed on a fair value basis. So I don't.
Also has interest rate in there as well.
But didn't we already conclude in cost that we're going to de-emphasize the management performance metrics? So you're just saying we got to be consistent throughout.
That's right. And I don't know that it'll work as a distinction. The distinction is whether you look at other stuff, right?
I'm fine as long as we have a fair value option. Okay, so see that. All right. So the staff put forward recommendations in questions 1 and 2. I'll call them together. So subject to some de-emphasizing the performance metrics, which I think is consistent where we were before. Who agrees with the staff recommendations? That's 7. Okay. You want to take a break and come back in, say, 10, 15 minutes, talk about leases?
Yeah, 5 steps forward. 5 steps
okay.
The hour.
All right. Bye.